You're listening to 90.1 FM People Powered Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Ron Topi, and this is your North State Water Report.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall. And it falls into a trickle, and the trickle is flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel. In a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground. And in my heart, the chains falling apart. The wildness in my soul. And for once in life, for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood. Our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, a tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth. And when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down. Water rushing to the sea, and now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. The river is free. Water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel. In a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground. And in my heart, the chains falling apart. Water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. We'll be right back.
And welcome back. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your local partner with the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts have been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Tires Plus, the complete auto repair technicians at Tires Plus provide year-round services and maintenance for your vehicle, including scheduled maintenance, oil changes, AC and cooling systems, powder coating, and engine repair, along with Cooper, Michelin, and all types of ag tires. Located at 624 Broadway Street, Tires Plus Complete Auto Repair can be reached at 530-342-8338 and at tirespluschico.com and on Facebook. So welcome back. You are listening to the North State Water Report on 90.1 FM, people-powered community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. On tonight's show, I have my guest will be Dave Steindorf, and he is a hydropower specialist with American Whitewater. But first, I'm going to report on a couple of big stories unfolding in the North State. On the Klamath River Dam Removal Project, they've reached their first milestone with the completion of the removal of COPCO 2 Dam in September and the Iron Gate COPCO 1 Dam removal will begin January 24th. Stay tuned as I plan on having a guest soon for a good update on that project. I'll probably get Regina from Save California Salmon to come on and give us a big update on how the river's recovering so far after the COPCO 2 removal. I've been following some of her work lately on that, and it looks like the river is doing amazing up there. In other dam removal news, PG&E plans to remove dams on the Eel River Potter Valley project beginning in 2028, so stay tuned for that, and hopefully that project comes to fruition in a few years. In salmon-related news, Dan Bacher, a longtime independent journalist reporting on the North State's fisheries and California water policy. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard Dan on my show several times in the last year. He reported some not-so-good news about Fall Run Chinook salmon returns. While the Mokelumne River, a tributary of the San Joaquin River, had a record number of returning fall Chinook, the Coleman National Fish Hatchery on Butte Creek, which is the main stem of the Sacramento River, had the second lowest recorded return. The Feather River Hatchery, which is operated solely by CDFW, which is California Department of Fish and Wildlife, has yet to release any official numbers. And the only source that I found reporting on the Feather River Hatchery is an Action News piece linking an increase in salmon population with a spawning habitat restoration project on the Feather River. They cited that this year was an increase from the last 3 years of drought, but doesn't surpass years that had historical counts. Yeah, it doesn't say much. Because they're not giving out numbers, and from what I've been told, CDFW Director Chuck Bonham has banned state hatchery staff from talking with journalists and instead turning them towards CDFW's main communications office. If you want to follow more of Dan Bacher's work, his latest piece was published at recordnet.com, which is the Stockton Records website. Dan is also a regular contributor to Daily KOs, the Stockton Record, the Sacramento News and Review, and the Fish Sniffer. Dan actually helped found that paper, and it's a recreational fisherman's guide. You can also find Dan, that's Dan, D-A-N, Bacher, B-A-C-H-E-R, on Facebook, where he regularly posts links to his articles. Also, stay tuned, because I'll be having Dan return to the show early next year to make sense out of a lot of this stuff that's going on with all the different salmon fisheries on the different rivers and the hatcheries. And he's a wealth of information about, you know, what's going on with all that and the different policies and problems with all these hatcheries. Now, on with the show. And I'm really happy to have Dan live in the studio with me. He happens to live in Chico, so he was able to come into the studio with me tonight. Like I said, he's a hydropower specialist for the organization American Whitewater. Since 2005, Dave has worked to improve the operation of hydropower dams for environmental and recreational purposes in his capacity as California Stewardship Director and hydropower specialist at American Whitewater. Dave has 20 years of direct experience in hydropower licensing, working as a consultant for hydropower companies and non-governmental organizations. During his tenure, Dave has directly been involved in the relicensing of more than 20 hydropower projects located throughout California. This involvement includes the development of study plans, implementation of studies, and engaging in hydropower license negotiations. Dave also served as the chairman of the California Hydropower Reform Coalition, or CHRC, for 15 years, from 2007 through 2021, and is currently on the steering committee of the Hydropower Reform Coalition, the HRC. How you doing, Dave? Let's make sure your mic's on.
All right, are we here?
All right, we got you live.
Good.
All right. We're going to be talking mainly tonight about PG&E and its operations of hydropower dams here in Northern California. But first, why don't you tell our listeners about how you entered this world of river conservation and became a hydropower specialist?
Yeah, how do you get to become one of those? Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Ron. I really appreciate the offer, and it's great to be here talking about this important stuff. Yeah, so I basically started engaging with rivers when I was old enough to hold the fishing rod. My dad, I think, taught me to fly fish when I was about 7. Then a little bit later in life, I actually learned to whitewater kayak, and that was just another avenue to be engaged with rivers. And I was actually a high school social science teacher out in Willows, and had been doing that for 5 years. And then one day somebody said, there's this meeting going on and you should show up. And that's how, quite often many of us, that's how our careers in this stuff starts, is you show up to a meeting. And it had to do with the licensing of the Rock Creek Cresta hydropower project up on the Feather River. And I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know what relicensing was. And but I get in there and there's all these folks from PG&E, I mean, lawyers and engineers and biologists and other conservation groups. Caltrout was there. I think Friends of the River was there. And I was just amazed that I could just, like, show up. And people kind of sort of had to listen to you a little bit. So I realized that I kind of found my niche in that world fairly fast. And then completed that relicensing, and then started working on the one upstream from that. All this as a volunteer, and then eventually worked into where I was actually doing consulting work, and actually working for hydropower companies. So that was a good experience to be on the other side and being one of the entities that went out and gathered the information necessary to go through this process to figure out how these projects should be operated. So that actually took several years, and then eventually became staff at American Whitewater, as you said, back in 2005.
Wow. So that's being involved in this licensing process. Can't even imagine what that takes.
Yeah, and just to give you a little background on what that is, because you start talking about licensing. Well, what the heck is that? Well, all non-federally operated power projects, meaning if they're not operated by the Corps of Engineers or Bureau of Reclamation, they have to get a license from the federal government to operate. And the reason is they're using water that's a public resource.
And that's through FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And I've always wondered, maybe you can answer this question briefly, how, you know, companies like PG&E that own all these power dams that have to be relicensed every so many years.
30 to 50 years, yeah.
How are they able to operate for over 20 years sometimes under an expired license?
Yeah, no, it's interesting you mentioned that. I was just talking with some of my colleagues about that last week, and it really is a big problem that, for instance, the Oroville project, that license expired, I want to say it was in 2007. And then there were some delays related to State Water Resources Control Board getting their water quality certification out. National Marine Fisheries Service had to get a biological opinion. And that license was, what we understood, ready to be issued at the beginning of 2017. And then they had a little problem with their spillway over there, which many of us remember. Yeah. And it has just gone underground since then. It's in FERC's hands, and we're waiting for them to issue the license and their menu.
15, 16 years now?
Yeah, and it's really – and most of the licenses that are delayed now in California are all at the hands of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We're waiting on their action for those projects to move forward. And
I know the McLeod Pitt River system is under relicensing for over a decade now too, right?
Yeah, I worked on that one, and by for all practical purposes, the meetings and the licensing process on that one, I want to say that ended in 2013 probably. Mm-hmm. And has been waiting since then for, you know, not just FERC, but also State Water Board to get their certification completed. But it's time for these things to move along, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if my license expires for a local business in town, I can't keep operating for the next 10, 15, 20 years or however long.
Right. And they're operating on the conditions that they had in their previous license, which quite often were completely inadequate to protect fish and other aquatic resources.
Yeah, totally antiquated. So anyways, let's kind of hone in here on what we really wanted to talk about tonight. And in June of this previous summer, 2023, you testified on behalf of the California Hydropower Reform Coalition to the Public Utilities Commission of the State of California in regards to PG&E's transfer of ownership of its hydropower stations to a new company called Pacific Generation. Tell us about what this transfer of ownership is all about.
Yeah, so the process actually started a little over a year ago. PG&E filed a petition with the California Public Utilities Commission stating that they would like to sell off 49% of their interest in all of their generation facilities, not just hydropower, but hydro, gas, wind, solar, everything except for their nuclear facility at Diablo Canyon. And so their plan is to sell off that 49% and raise some capital. As we all know, PG&E is in a world of hurt to have the capital, one, to pay off fire victims, but also just to maintain their facilities.
Yeah, pretty much since Camp Fire, they've been looking to dump a lot of their assets, right? A lot of their generation assets.
Yeah, and that's been their plan. And initially, to be honest, I looked at this with an open mind, like this could be something that might be helpful. They certainly need some capital to maintain their facilities. But looking at it more closely, myself and my colleagues at the Hydropower Reform Coalition, we realized that this really wasn't in the interest of rivers. It wasn't in the interest of ratepayers. And really, it's primarily about protecting PG&E's shareholder value.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, what is this new company, this Pacific Generation?
Yeah, so Pacific Generation, you know, if this goes through, they stated in their their proposal that it could potentially only have one employee to manage all this. Yeah, which is crazy, right? That's not possible. But they also state that PG&E staff would continue to operate the facilities, and so nothing would change there. And we said in our testimony to CPUC, that doesn't necessarily give us comfort because their current operations have been substandard. I mean, that's what led to the campfire and other issues out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the that leads right into my next question is, why is this transfer of ownership to Pacific Generation concerning?
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of my biggest concerns is, again, just as when they went through the most recent bankruptcy, none of these are getting to the core of addressing the safety issues that exist at PG&E. And I want to be clear here that I have a lot of friends that work for PG&E. There are a lot of good people over there. Mm-hmm. But there has been a direction at the company for a number of years to not pay attention to specific safety issues that have occurred and will occur in the future. And that's got to change. And there's nothing in this proposal that will do that. And so what I see is putting another layer of bureaucracy, because even though there's going to be one person, the actions of Pacific Generation are going to be at the direction of their president, and they have an oversight board. PG&E is going to be on that board. But that's just a whole other layer, and none of that really goes to address the underlying safety issues, the need for additional O&M on their projects. And it's hard to imagine how that's going to happen. But the one thing it will do, normally corporations, if they want to raise money, you go sell common stock. That's why the stock market exists. And so the reason why, obviously, they don't want to do that is it will dilute their value of their existing stock pool. Right. But that's not really the CPUC's job to maintain their shareholder value.
Yeah. I mean, our rates have certainly been going up, so someone's going to have to pay for all of the...
And just did again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, we're going to get into a little bit more about all those safety issues here, specifically on Butte Creek. But what facilities, how many facilities will be transferred? Like, how many facilities does PG&E have around the state of California that, you know, are potentially in states of lack of maintenance?
Well, in total, PG&E has 167 dams, 97 reservoirs, and 62 powerhouses. So that's an enormous fleet of water structures out there that need to be maintained. Some of them, as we look at Butte Creek, were built on mining infrastructure.
Right.
And so they're quite aged. They all need constant upgrade and repair, and particularly when we're looking at the potential impacts of climate change and the discussions that have been out there about what are called arc storm events, severe rainfall events. All of these facilities need to be in tip-top condition if they're going to weather those types of events.
Well, yeah, a couple of the events last summer and just last year on Butte Creek were due to heavy rainfall in the spring, and then August there was all the snow melt and they had heavy flows.
Right.
That. How many do you have any idea how many or if any of those existing dams and stations that they own, are any of those decommissioned at this point? Like, any of them non-operable, but they're still out there?
Oh, many. Yeah. In fact, just right out our back door, you've got the DeSable-Centerville project, which operates, you know, it starts up at Philbrook Reservoir. Water comes down the West Branch of the Feather, then is diverted over to Butte Creek, and then there's diversion up higher on Butte Creek. But also further down on the West Branch, there's the Miocene project, which diverts water out of the West Branch. And that water, when it was operating, actually went all the way to Oroville. And it was part of, the Cal Water system over there. That hasn't operated since the campfire. And it's still there in various states of disrepair. And sadly, you know, these structures have impacts. This summer... last spring, a young man, you know, going to school at Chico was up there at the head dam and jumped off of it and was sucked back under the recirculating current under there, and he didn't come out. And he drank. So here's a dam that's in place. Yikes. That's actually caused a fatality, will cause another fatality, and yet it's providing no public benefit. So these things need to come out of the rivers. They, you know, leaving industrial waste like that in rivers is unacceptable.
Yeah, and what are the ecological effects to fish and wildlife and everything? You know, the whole ecology of the creek.
Absolutely.
The river. So yeah, wow, that is a lot of infrastructure that they have to maintain out there, and I was going to ask you to kind of go into talk about each facility, but maybe you could just talk about, you have a little bit already, but you know, just in general, what are the major risks to public safety and the ecology of the rivers that all of these facilities are on?
Well, one of the issues that we brought up that I've actually known about this for some time, but it hasn't been on the public record in any official way, and that's a huge issue that exists up at Lake Almanor. Lake Almanor is by far the largest reservoir in California that is that high up in any watershed. Mm-hmm. You know, 1.3 million acre feet at, I think it's 4,500 feet roughly. And so it's a big reservoir way up in the watershed. And so the problem you have anytime you have a reservoir that big up in the watershed, if something were to happen to that reservoir, you would end up with a cascading effect all the way down the system. But you assume, okay, this should be in tip-top shape. Well, the spillway at Lake Almanor has actually never been used.
Yeah, I've heard that's a really high risk. Like, every year right. It becomes a higher risk.
And the reason why it's never been used is because if they use it, they'll actually inundate part of the town of Chester. So you would think right. A basic thing that you would look at, like if you go through this relicensing process, or even if dam safety officials look at it, if you use the flood control facilities, you shouldn't be flooding the adjacent town.
From what I understand, that is a huge problem all the way down the Feather River and culminating at the Oroville Dam, and the, right. And the flood controls downstream of the dam aren't up to capacity for a maximum flow out of the dam.
Right. Well, and it's surprisingly difficult. I spent quite a bit of time trying to research that to figure out what is the flow of what's called the probable maximum flood.
Look into Patrick Porgans's work. I've right. had Patrick on my show several times.
And yep. So there's and Ron Stork at Friends of the River. I mean, yeah. He was the one who called out, you know, what was going to happen at Oroville before it happened, and right. You know, after they tried to use the air quotes emergency spillway there. But yeah, no, it's a huge issue, and it's not. I mean, I certainly nobody wants to see Chester get flooded. But the real issue here is that feature, the spillway, will never be tested until we're in the thick of it, right? And Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has already called out some deficiencies with that spillway. And I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if it were to happen, it would be catastrophic for the state of California. Because there's no way that Oroville could consume a million acre feet of water and survive that, most likely. So, you know, we burnt down some towns. That's not a good thing. And, you know, there's been quite a bit of devastation there. That would all pale in comparison to what would happen if you would take out the tallest dam in the country.
And that, you know, that's another link here with the public safety issue is you mentioned we, you know, they burnt down some towns. Maybe you can connect those dots with some of our listeners that might not understand that those hydropower projects are directly right. related to the power line problems that right. that have happened.
I've said it before, and others might quibble with this, but I don't think there is a region in the country that's been more impacted by hydropower operations than Butte and Plumas County. And that comes from...
That's in the last five years.
Yeah, you look at the transmission lines that failed that started the campfire or carried transmission from the hydropower project down to the valley. That's what failed. That's what started the campfire. Then you've got the Oroville Spillway incident, you know, obviously related to that dam, hydropower and water supply. And then you've got the Dixie Fire, you know, that also started by the same transmission lines that are up there in the canyon. So there, and I think hydropower has value. It has a place in our grid in order to help us make the transition to clean energy. But these facilities have to be maintained up to a very high standard. And again, going back to this transaction, it's not clear to me how this will help make that transition. How is this going to get us to a place where we truly trust that these facilities are absolutely top-notch and there's no possibility that we're going to see these type of failures in the future?
Take billions of dollars of work up there, I would expect, but
and PG&E's estimate is that it's going to take somewhere between $40 and $50 billion just through 2026 to do the type of operations upgrades that they need, and they're saying that this transaction is going to net them somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million. So there's a big gap there.
Oh yeah. Anyways, let's hone in on Butte Creek a little bit here.
Sure.
And you know, I understand the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also known as FERC, has recently come down pretty hard on PG&E concerning the project failures of just this past summer. You know, I was reading through this document that you sent me a copy of, and PG&E had three incidents this past summer in 2023. There was a Butte Canal winter storm drainage incident. There was a Hendricks Canal erosion damage incident, and then the Butte Canal failure incident, all within just months of each other, and every one of them put sediment into the creek, endangering.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, again, the Butte Creek project is like kind of the poster child for having an old project that was built, you know, during the gold rush era.
Those flumes were part of hydraulic mining processes, yeah. And now they serve for irrigation and hydropower.
Right. And one of the challenges with Butte Creek with that one, you know, normally when projects are old and they're failing like this, you know, our answer is pretty simple. They should just be taken out. This is the case with Battle Creek right now.
Yeah,
PG&E has said they don't want to operate anymore. We need to take that out. Potter Valley, which you mentioned earlier, you know, these projects cost ratepayers money. They have huge ecological impacts. They should come out. Butte Creek is tricky because we actually want the water that's diverted from the West Branch Feather to come over to Butte Creek. That's what helps sustain the salmon population there.
If all that infrastructure was removed, then the salmon would be able to get back to Butte Meadows, though. Then they wouldn't really need that water.
Well, I think that would be a spirited discussion about whether you'd have enough water to maintain that. And then there's, you know, some challenges getting all the way up to Butte Meadows. But, at, you know, certainly like the Centerville Head Dam needs to come out. Again, why that hasn't operated for over a decade, now it should be out of the river. You know, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But these failures are, you know, they're going to continue. You know, I will say that I do think that PG&E, by and large, has tried to operate that project for the benefit of the salmon. And I know they have a lot of dedicated staff up there trying to do that. But the problem is they're trying to keep this thing strapped together with baling wire and whatever else they have. And we would like to see them move to a place where we can find a final solution for that project where it's not strapped together with baling wire. And we've approached PG&E. We actually wrote a letter to Patty Poppe, the CEO of PG&E, last year and said, let us help you find a final solution for this. It's not costing ratepayers money. That's better for the salmon. The response was kind of like, well, we don't have any non-economic projects. Like, we were shocked to get that response. I mean, it didn't make any sense.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I guess they, you know, they're trying to operate for the benefit of fish, but they're also pretty responsible for that major fish kill two summers ago by not releasing water soon enough. And all of those, you know, that record run You know, almost 19,000. I was one of the final numbers, right around 19,000.
Right.
Pre-spawn died because the water got too warm. And
we just can't continue to do that, right? I mean, we're at that place where we could see the last salmon swim in the Golden Gate, and it's time for some measures to shore up these places like Butte Creek, like Battle Creek, like Potter Valley, to make sure that we're doing everything they can. And particularly, again, when these systems that aren't providing any benefit, you know, we're not talking about taking power out of the grid that's going to make a difference.
That's the whole thing. I mean, I guess if they went through and did the analysis of how much power they're actually getting out of some of these stations and then trying to transmit that power on power lines that are antiquated through tinderbox forest,
well,
doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
And on net, it costs PG&E, as even without the failures they had this year, it costs them at least as much just to operate the project as it they get in power revenue. So, and it's been that way for decades. This isn't a new thing. And that's my biggest complaint, more than what they're trying to do to keep this thing cobbled together, is not being willing to engage to find a solution for this project that makes sense for the fish and it makes sense for their ratepayers.
Yeah, I mean, I went up there in August after that side of that canal collapsed and all that water cascaded down the hillside into Butte Creek and turned the water red, and I happened to get up there the day that they had the cement trucks in there and they were patching the hole, and it really wasn't that big of a hole, but it was enough to where, because we hiked down the hillside that it eroded, and there were 10-foot deep gouges in that hillside of sediment that just, you know, was forced on that hill. It had to be just a torrent for about 10 hours.
Right. It was
pouring down there.
And I think it said in the letter that came back from FERC that they actually had a flow discrepancy where there was more water at the top of the flume than at the bottom of the flume for about a month, I think it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, that tells you they've been going on for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. It was leaking for a while, and then it finally just blew out.
Right.
And you know, there was, according to FERC here, there was like a 9.5-hour delay between, you know, it went undetected. The flow reduction went undetected for approximately 9.5 hours.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if this is a regular thing either, but as far as that August canal failure, you know, FERC says here, your analysis included an overview of potentially adverse effects of federally listed species, including Central Valley Spring Run Chinook salmon, Central Valley steelhead, and foothill yellow-legged frog from the increase in and deposition of sediment in Butte Creek. However, you did not acknowledge any specific effects that occurred on these species from increased sediment load.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if that's a regular thing where they, you know, they just go through the motions of filing, you know, filling out a report, sending it in, saying, oh, yeah, there could have been problems for these fish and frogs, but...
But we're not going to give any specifics about, you know, and if you don't get out there right away, you're not going to find them, so...
Yeah. I mean, you know, those salmon, the ones that did survive, I'm sure a good amount of them survived because they can get deep enough below that sediment flow in the summer pools that they hold off in. But then when they had to go down and spawn in the fall, I mean, I walked the water, you know, I walked that creek for quite a few miles a few times after that sediment flow, and all of those gravel beds where they spawned below the Honey Run Bridge had like 3 inches of sediment on top of all of those gravel beds. It was horrible conditions for the salmon.
And that turbidity is just going to, with every rainstorm this year, is going to just keep feeding into the creek.
Every step you take, it just poof, this big this big cloud came up. Wasn't good. I mean, is this a regular thing for FERC to actually come down pretty hard on that one, PG&E.
That was pretty harsh. And
you probably see a lot of these.
Oh, yeah. My inbox is full every day with those. One thing that's really interesting thing that's been going on, and what was interesting about this letter back from FERC, is that people that operate hydropower projects, the licensees, they can send things to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that are it was actually came about after 9/11 when they didn't want terrorists to get a hold of information on dams and what's called critical energy infrastructure. And so when that goes in, it's not public. Well, what's been happening is more and more, you know, licensees are just checking that box and putting whatever they want as basically top secret. We can't see it, whether it has to do with critical energy infrastructure or not. And that's frustrating because as a member of the public, you want to be able to see that. What's interesting here is that FERC responded back, and this was a public filing that everybody can see, and actually disclosed much of the information that PG&E had filed as critical energy infrastructure. So that's really not ideally how it should work, but at least FERC recognized the need for the public to be able to see this information. So that was actually a change, and I think beneficial.
Yeah, that's interesting. So PG&E's report isn't public, but FERC's response to their report is. And
right.
That's how we're reading this right now.
Right, because we didn't even know about the second flume failure over on the, well, it wasn't complete failure, but overtopping over on the Hendricks Canal coming out of the West Branch.
Yeah, that one's described as, where is it in here? That happened in April or March or something where it overtopped with a heavy rain that happened over about a 3 or 4 day heavy rain. And I mean, these canals there, all you got to do is take a hike up there and just see the condition of them. I mean, because we walked by where they were patching, mm-hmm. and there's no water in it because they had it shut off at that point. And walking it, you can just see where there's all these other spots. It's like, wow, that's probably going to fail pretty soon. Wow, that's probably going to fail pretty soon. There's cracks all over it.
And that's where I think that's the real failure here is we knew when we started the relicensing on this project back in 2003, something like that, PG&E knew then that this project was not economically viable. And that's when we should have started a discussion about what's the final disposition of this project. What do we need to do and start on that path? And instead, we've kicked the can down the road for 20 years, and we still, it hasn't gotten better up there. As you pointed out, you just go walk up and down the flumes and go, okay, this part's going to fail next, and then the next part. And we need a fix that makes sense, that's not going to require a ton of maintenance each and every year, and do that because tons of money has been invested on Butte Creek to protect salmon, to bring back the runs to the level that they have back in the 1990s. That's a huge investment, but we need to protect that investment with having the upstream water infrastructure that makes sense.
Yeah, we're going to take a brief station identification break. You are listening to 90.1 FM, People Power Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you've been listening to the North State Water Report. And my guest tonight is Dave Steindorf, who is a hydropower specialist for the organization American Whitewater. We're going to talk briefly about American Whitewater and stuff when we return from this break. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and Community Radio in Northern California. For more information, visit dalampeconstruction.com. And by Mountain Sports, providing outdoor clothing and equipment for hiking, backpacking, camping, traveling, and enjoying the great outdoors. Mountain Sports is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. at 176 East 3rd Street in downtown Chico, serving Chico and the North State since 1975. And we're going to get back to our discussion with Dave here. And we've kind of been all over the place. We've been talking about just in general hydropower projects throughout California, some of the challenges with these hydropower projects, and specifically we've been talking about the problems on Butte Creek that have occurred in this last summer, really, and just this whole licensing project process for these facilities, and you know, PG&E wants to transfer these facilities to essentially a corporation that they form themselves, and so nothing will really change as far as who's operating and maintaining these facilities. It'll just be a different corporate name on whatever filings they have to make and whatnot. Is that essentially about what they really want to pull off?
Well, it is. I mean, that's what they said. We're going to continue to operate the facilities. It's going to be our same staff. But it's not completely clear. I mean, for instance, I don't know if now when I go to a meeting on any of one of the projects that I'm engaged on, all the stuff up and down the Feather, McLeod, the, you know, projects on the American, if now there's going to be a entity or representative from Pacific Generation in the room also. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be investors that are going to invest billions of dollars here into this company. They're going to want to have a say on how things go. Now, depending upon who that investor is, that might bring you some comfort. If it's an entity that actually has a lot of experience in operating power facilities in general or hydropower facilities specifically, that would be great. But if it's private equity firms or hedge funds who simply want to extract as much revenue as they can of this entity as quickly as they can and then just leave the wreckage behind them, not so interested in that.
Right.
And again, I just think it creates a layer of complexity that I don't think is necessary. I think PG&E has the ability to go sell common stock. They want to raise money. That's the way to go do it. And yeah, the folks in PG's management who own a lot of common stock at PG&E, they're not going to be happy about that.
They don't want to devalue their own investment.
Right. But that's, you know, that's not, you know, not to be callous, but that's not our problem or the CPUC's problem.
Right. So as far as this transfer, is there any legal things that the hydropower reform coalition or organizations like American Whitewater would be able to take to help, you know, maybe stop this?
Yeah, so we intervened in the process, and as I sent to you, you know, my testimony, some other colleagues of mine, Chris Schutz at the California Sport Fishing Protectors and the Lights, also provided testimony. We filed the briefs, and it is a little difficulty because we don't have a ton of resources out there, and we, you know, work with an attorney on this stuff, but they, you know, they have an empty refrigerator they need to fill up too, and so it's challenged being, you know, resource constrained. But I think we've really made a difference in that there's nobody else in this proceeding that has any knowledge about particularly the hydropower facilities at PG&E. We've had other entities tell us that they really appreciated us engaging in this way. Although it is interesting, there are several other hydropower operators, Placer County Water Agency, Nevada Irrigation District, who've all weighed into this proceeding, also in strong opposition of this transfer.
I mean, do some of those other entities want to purchase some of these projects from PG&E? I mean, could they fraction them all off and sell them piecemeal?
Absolutely. Placer County Water Agency said, rather than sell this off to some third party, why don't you just let – they have an offer. They say, why don't you just let us buy it?
And some of them are cooperated, right?
Right. Well, and they get a significant of their water for their water customers at Placer County Water Agency from the PG&E project, and they just want to be – in control of their own destiny. And it's not a great project, right? It's not a big power producer, and it's similarly built on old mining infrastructure. So they would only weigh and say that they wanted, they've got to be in a very serious situation where they say our best answer is to buy it. They have to really be concerned about the operations of that project. Mm-hmm. And they are. That's why they want to buy it.
I mean, I'm sure PG&E has probably done due diligence and looked into all of those potential scenarios of dropping these assets off, you know, getting them off their books, yet at the same time, maybe it's not going to bring them in enough money as they feel they will get through Pacific Generation.
I've been working with folks over there for, you know, 20 plus years. I don't know what they're thinking. Yeah. I honestly don't, because to me, in a logical world, they would look at selling off, like I said, the Drum Spalding project. We'd be looking at, you know, having another entity operate Butte Creek, you know, Battle Creek. They should have been down that road, you know.
Seems like due diligence to me to look into all those potential ways to take care of these projects.
Yeah, it's unclear. That's all I can. And we've made overtures to say let's help you guys figure out a disposition. And again, that will be better for ratepayers. These things are costing ratepayers tons of money and not producing the power that they need. I mean, just a quick thing. I mean, back in 2017, I actually got invited to testify before the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House in D.C. And part of that was about hydropower and licensing, but a lot of it had to do with energy stuff. And the reality, we need forms of energy that are flexible to mesh up with wind and solar, because wind and solar go up and down in terms of the output, and some hydropower can do that very well. These projects cannot.
They're using so much coal and gas right now to keep solar and wind essentially viable without something to back up wind and solar. It just we don't have the same amount of power, and maybe we don't need the same amount of power.
Well, and
maybe
actually,
we really do need as a society to just drastically cut back our power needs.
Yeah, that's
and that seems to me to be the only thing that makes sense. Yeah. But that's for a whole nother.
But we can also, I mean, there are some projects that make sense, but there's a whole bunch of them that just don't pencil out anymore, and they just shouldn't remain impacting rivers if they're not providing value for the grid, value for the customers, and also impacting rivers.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left, so hopefully we've educated folks a little bit on who FERC is and what PG&E owns up there as far as power stations and the challenges with relicensing and you know, what can happen when they're not maintained. You just have to live in Butte County to understand that. I wanted to pivot a little bit here and talk about the organization that you work for, American Whitewater. And, you know, what does American Whitewater do, what do you see, and, you know, what, as far as coming from a perspective of working for American Whitewater, what are the biggest challenges are there to restoring whitewater and the ecology of many of our rivers, and maybe there's some opportunities out there?
Well, American Whitewater is actually one of the oldest river conservation organizations in the country. Our mission is to protect, preserve, and restore America's whitewater resources and provide opportunities for people to enjoy them safely. Clearly, we're focused on upper watershed rivers. Our membership has primarily been whitewater paddlers, you know, rafters, kayakers, canoeists, etc. But really, we probably do more of the FERC relicensing of hydro projects in the country than any other organization. We've just figured out that is a really good way to put water back in rivers, and sometimes to actually take dams out.
That's the biggest block too. Good white water and healthy rivers is all the dams.
Right. And I often say that the FERC relicensing process is long, cumbersome, complicated. But the alternative is just to stand on the bank of a river and cry. So you do it.
That's what I hear from a lot of folks that get knee deep in that.
Yeah, I've been fortunate in the time that I've worked for American Whitewater to be able to see the fruits of the labor. When I started work on the projects on the Feather, the flow releases down the Rock Creek and Cresta reaches were between 50 and 100 cubic feet per second, and right now today they're running five times that amount. And we're seeing the fishery restored. We have boating opportunities up there, and it just looks like a river again. When I first started driving up that river, it was just a collection of stagnant ponds. Mm-hmm. So it's nice when you can actually see the benefits of what you're working on.
Some good white water on the Feather River.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some of the best. And the Feather is interesting because absent the projects, unlike a lot of other rivers south of the Feather, it would have 1,000 cubic feet per second in it every single day of the year.
All the way down.
And was one of the premier rainbow trout fisheries on the West Coast. And had those projects not been built, it would be the whitewater mecca for the entire United States, hands down. There's just so many runs. And we've been able to restore some of that. We have regular recreational releases. We actually put on the largest river festival on the West Coast up there in the fall, the Feather River Festival. And it's just great to see that canyon start to come back to life.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I know the McLeod River needs a lot of work like that, too.
Yeah.
I work with the Winnemem Wintu up there on the McLeod River, and they've been heavily involved in the relicensing of that whole project. And
yeah, and that is an amazing river, and you probably know this, but the,
some of the best white water in the world, over there, at least on this continent, from what I understand.
And the wealthiest families in San Francisco back in the 1800s went and bought up most of the property along that.
The Bali Baca Fishing Club and the Hearst family owns a huge stretch of that river.
Right. And I would say people with unimaginable wealth don't buy crappy real estate. So,
right. Yeah. Well, there's some pretty good, I mean, it's not a, I hate to say a good chance, but there is a chance that the Winnemem Wintu tribe may be getting the Bali Baca, that land of the Bali Baca Fishing Club back.
That would be a great, back from Westlands Water District.
Have
that
you,
would be.
Has American Whitewater done any work with tribes?
Oh, yeah.
As far as working on these projects, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. We've worked quite a bit with tribes up on the Klamath. In fact, we're working with a group to see that the tribes on the Klamath, the Karuk and the Yurok, are actually going to be the first people that go down the Klamath River after the dams come out. So,
oh, that's great.
It's going to be super exciting to see that.
It's going to be
a good day.
Yeah. It just seems like, I've been an environmentalist and, an activist and whatnot for probably 25, going on 30 years now, and more and more I've realized that groups like fishing clubs and fishing coalitions and like groups like American Whitewater are some of the biggest allies those relationships, networking need to be stronger. Because you're just the more natural allies in these fights for conservation.
Absolutely.
And that gets me to, we've got about, it's actually 7, so we're going to squeeze this in real quick. Thankfully, I have a pre-recorded show coming up right after me. how can people, like you said, this FERC response was made public. Sometimes PG&E's reports are public. How can people